Nobody does it better than Regent Seven Seas Cruises. Enjoy all-inclusive, unrivaled luxury with unlimited shore excursions, indulgent cuisine, personalized service, and more aboard spacious all-suite ships. Visit rssc.com to experience the unrivaled.
Pepsi Prebiotic Cola in original and cherry vanilla. That Pepsi taste you love with no artificial sweeteners, only 30 calories, just 5 grams of sugar, and 3 grams of prebiotic fiber. That great Pepsi taste with even more to love. Pepsi Prebiotic Cola. Unbelievably Pepsi.
Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to another episode of The Interviews, the spin-off show that rounds up our sit-downs with cinema's finest. It's Saul Goodman. And speaking of which, Bob Odenkirk played Saul Goodman, Walter White's slimy lawyer on Breaking Bad, and Better Call Saul, two of the greatest TV series of all time. As a lot of TV stars do, he's pivoted into making movies, but few could have seen this particular pivot coming, because rather than playing Saul Goodman types on the big screen or doing out-and-out comedy, as you might expect from an American sketch comedy legend, he is the co-star and co-creator of Mr. Show along with David Cross, Odenkirk has become a Jerry action hero, kicking ass and taking names in the likes of Nobody and its sequel, and now Ben Wheatley's Normal, which opens today, Friday, May 15th, in which he plays a small-town sheriff who finds himself facing off against, well, a small town. Odenkirk came to London this week, and I went along to talk to him in a swanky hotel suite about becoming an action hero late in the day, working with Ben Wheatley, comedy, and movies, you know, that sort of thing. It was a lovely chat with a lovely man. Oh, and while this isn't a spoiler chat per se, he does heavily hint at the fate of a supporting character here, so maybe tread with caution. Oh, and one more thing. He also, because we were talking about horror movies, he also talks about his reaction to Zach Cregger's Weapons, and he maybe kind of spoils that movie as well. So if you haven't seen Weapons, maybe skip that bit once we start talking about horror movies. All set? Enjoy. Bob Odenkirk, star of Normal, how are you?
I'm great. I love this movie. I love watching it. I love watching it with an audience. Uh-huh. I get to watch it again tonight. This is probably my 10th or 11th time. And obviously I don't need to. They always say, do you want to go eat? Do you want to go? I go, no, I want to sit in that crowd and I want to watch. I'm not going to say what happens to Henry Winkler, but I want to see that happen.
I was going to say, is your favorite bit? Yeah.
You know, it's such a moment where the movie shifts tone.
Yep.
And there's a couple of them in here.
Yep.
It's like a rocket boost moment where we just supercharge this thing. The movie has a number of those, and it's just a great fun to watch with an audience.
What's the reaction usually like? Just people going apeshit?
They laugh and they shout and scream and they're, you know, I mean, they're frightened and scared and they laugh. Yeah.
A little aroused,
and they
maybe
can't believe,
as well.
Well, also they're a little bit, not appalled, but they're a little sad.
It's Henry Winkler.
It's Henry
National
Winkler.
National treasure. What are you doing? It's a hell of a thing. I don't want to spoil it, but we, you know, people can glean from our conversation that something bad happens to the Vaughns.
Yeah, you don't want to give spoilers, but
no, of course not.
It's great fun.
It's an amazing, amazing moment.
And the fact that it happens, I won't say anymore. Where it happens in the movie matters too, because film is such a, it's got so many surprises in it. And the way they're placed by Derek Kolstad, who wrote the screenplay, and the way they're prepped and presented by Ben Wheatley, who directed, really do surprise the audience. They don't see them coming.
They really don't. It's a ton of fun. If you had said to me, 6-7 years ago, that one of my favorite subgenres in movies was Bob Odenkirk killing a whole bunch of fools, I'd have laughed in your face.
Yeah.
Bob, you must have felt the same way, right?
I absolutely felt the same way. And in fact, the training that I did for Nobody, which I looked at as free training, when you get older, you should try to stay in shape. It helps to have somebody coach you through it because, you know, what do you know? And so I had this guy, Daniel Bernhardt, who
you know from every action movie, you kicked the living shit out of him in Nobody,
yeah,
of course.
And he's just a great person.
Yeah.
And he trained me. And the whole time I'm doing it, I'm thinking, well, we'll probably never make this movie, but if we make it, what a funny thing to have gone to this place from where I started.
Yeah.
And how much I will surprise my friends and people like you who know pop culture and saw that I was on Larry Sanders and, you know, knew me from those things, to have gone to this place. And even obviously if it doesn't work, that will make perfect sense. But if it does work, or even if it kind of works, it'll be a delight.
A delight is absolutely right. What about your friends in comedy? How have they taken to this new action hero phase?
The reaction is flabbergasted. Like, I broke their brains. I gave them aneurysms, and I knew that I would. And the whole time I'm exercising in the gym, hours and hours and hours and months and months and months, I'm thinking, boy, if I can make this happen, I'm imagining the delight on the face of Robert Smigel, Dana Carvey, David Spade, Adam Sandler, Jack Black. You know, I'm imagining David Cross, all these friends of mine going, what? And watching it and going, what? What? There's no way I'm seeing what I'm seeing. And of course, you're in that category in your way because you're familiar with the culture and what I've done and how ludicrous it is that I could find myself to that place and then pull it off, which again was never a guarantee.
It's fascinating because I adore Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, and going back and rewatching it as I frequently do, it's a shame to not watch, to see Saul Goodman and he's not snapping necks and blowing punters away.
Oh, you mean you wish that it happened? And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well,
if Saul had tooled himself up.
Look, the notion of doing an action movie was because of Better Call Saul and the degree to which I got to do earnest scenes in that show that weren't Saul being a con man or, but honestly needing and wanting things and not getting them and then figuring another way to try to achieve those things. And to me, I was like, that's an action character. They basically are indefatigable and they have their heart on their sleeve. And when I say that about Saul, you might think, well, is his heart on his sleeve? Well, if you watch Breaking Bad, it is.
It is, yeah.
At many junctures.
Yeah.
And then in an overall way, in the journey of the show, you get closer and closer to who the guy is in his heart. And so I saw it as a half step. And that half step is guns and punches, you know, fists and guns. And so I thought, that's all I'm adding to this
mix.
It's
just a sidestep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit more this visual action, you know, sequences. And I was willing to train for them. And here we are. Three movies later.
Absolutely. You and Derek Kolstad have clearly clicked.
Yeah. I love Derek. He cares and knows action film the way I know sketch comedy.
Yeah.
He spent his life since he was 10 years old watching and thinking about action movie making. I did that with Monty Python and sketch comedy. So I know when to just shut up and do what Derek tells me to do. and even though there are so many moments in these films where the film, the story, the characters sort of leave Earth's orbit,
yeah,
and they enter into a comically broad place.
Yeah,
I can just trust it because it's what Derek knows we need to do, and that's what he has learned. And so, yeah. So I just, we're a great pair. And I, of course, my time doing Saul Goodman and some of the drama films that I've done has made me intrigued and interested in finding the backstory of characters. So in a movie like Normal,
yeah,
Ulysses, and the question I posed to Derek of why is this guy so reticent to investigate this town that clearly has got something going on with it. The previous sheriff died and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And there's money. They shouldn't have that kind of money. And there's guns and there's no need for that many guns.
Yeah.
And even, I know it's America, but trust me, even in America,
that's
there's no need for the level of munitions that this small town has.
Yeah.
And there's all these indicators that there's something awry. And why is Ulysses, an older guy who's clearly seen life, you know, putting things away in drawers and shutting the drawers and walking away and not wanting to know?
It's fascinating because the movie is, I've talked to Ben about this movie, and you know, he made a Western, a modern Western.
Yeah.
And it has this real slow burn. I mean, yeah. I loved the first 30 minutes because you really get into know this guy and you get into set up all the different characters in the yeah. town. And you're also thinking, it's an action movie.
Yeah.
At some point, the shit is going to hit the fan. But that slow build really allows you to pay it off in interesting right. ways.
And the thing is, I don't think I would ever do an action movie that follows the rhythms of, as you point out, action movies.
Yeah.
I just don't think I would do it. In fact, I've been offered a couple scripts that are live in that world. And I just am not interested. If we're not going to take some time, and we do in Nobody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we're not going to take, essentially it's between 20 and 35 minutes, and find out who this guy is, find out what the world is he lives in, find out what's motivating him, find out what he's working against.
Yeah.
And then go ahead. Then I can do it. Then we can do action for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do that. Those traditional action films that there's plenty of guys who'll do them.
They start with a big cold open, lots of devastation and yes. destruction in the first 5 minutes.
Right.
A real grabber.
In our defense, the opening, and this was one of my contributions, the Yakuza scene.
Yeah.
And yeah. I wanted that for a couple reasons. One, if you thought you were here to see Bob Odenkirk do a sweet, funny character, you right away warned that that's not what we're going to do, that there's going to be blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually.
Eventually.
And it's going to go to that level. So this movie's bloody and there's deaths that are, I haven't seen the movie Final Destination, but there were a couple deaths in our film that Derek and Ben both said, this is a Final Destination kill.
I know exactly what they're talking about.
You do.
Yeah. I do. Yeah, yeah, very much so. Because Ben, I've known Ben for a while and he's a lovely guy, but he's twisted.
Yeah.
He's very, very twisted.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you guys click immediately because you both have sketch comedy backgrounds? Obviously?
We sure did. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. In fact, probably within 1 minute of talking to him on the Zoom that we did, we were like, this is our man. Now, we had also seen Free Fire and
yeah.
some of his other films. I was particularly motivated by Free Fire mm-hmm. Because of the character and the acting and the degree to which Ben as a director is also like me wanting that texture in his characters. Mm. I'm not interested in doing the action movie that doesn't have that
yeah.
dimension. Yeah.
And did you bond over that?
Sure. I mean, we bonded over Ben constantly making jokes. You know what I mean? He's always making wisecracks and and also
he's very deadpan. Just his
confidence. Yes, yeah. He's very deadpan. Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, the action, the horror aspect was new.
Mm-hmm.
There are deaths in this film normal that mm-hmm. I perceive as being straight out of a horror film.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess I don't want to spoil it for people, but the old lady, I'll just say the old lady.
Just say the old lady. Yeah. Very few people walk away from this movie new. Unscathed.
Yeah. I don't really know that stuff. I don't watch it. And so that's Ben Wheatley.
Has it intrigued you though, Bob? Or are you thinking
it does intrigue
let's
me?
Let's watch that stuff now.
So look, my daughter Erin, who's 25 now, she just loves those movies. And she's loved them since she was like 10. I don't know what the attraction is. I did see Weapons.
Okay.
So
what do you think?
I thought it was good. I didn't like that in the end. It was just a lady who was doing witchy stuff.
Spells. Yeah, yeah.
That was not a. I thought it was going to be a metaphor for school shootings and
and then it goes
mass hysteria.
Yeah,
and it was just about a witch. It
goes in a different direction at the end. Yeah. It absolutely
ditches any thematic bigness mm-hmm. or resonance and says no, it's just an old lady who thinks she's a witch or is a witch.
Is a witch. Yeah very much so. So that was like a
bummer.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe you'll dive back into horror another time. Yeah, I'm sure Ben's put together a list, or he could put together a list
of movies that I should see.
Yeah.
I like the movie Repulsion.
Okay, that's a cracker.
By Polanski.
Yeah.
I can't really name too many other horror films that I've even seen.
So what were the movies that lit your fire growing up? Were they comedy films?
American Graffiti was a film that was the first movie that I saw that really got me and made me see what a movie can be. And Chinatown is my favorite film. Lehane, Annie Hall, mm-hmm. Zelig, Hoosiers. Is there a cohesive quality to those films that I love so much? I also love Jackie Chan Police Story.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I love Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
I can see that.
So look. I'm not a cinephile in a way that I'm delighted by just excellent storytelling in the film world, I think. I think if you don't sit with the characters and I get to know people and feel affection for them, I don't really care how adept you are at the formulas of filmmaking. Now, look, you might think I'm saying that I'm not the biggest Kubrick fan in the world. And if you're thinking that, well, you're a real jerk who's right.
I would never make that accusation, Bob. So you're not.
I mean, if I'm trying to characterize what I love in film, and I recognize how unbelievably proficient he is, and how mechanically pristine he is, I have to say, and yet somehow I would rather watch Hoosiers. What is it I'm liking? What is it that I'm wanting? You know what I mean? That
you want connection. You want an emotional connection.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because you come from, this sketch comedy background, and sketch comedy is just get in, get out.
Okay, but hold on a second. One of my favorite things about Mr. Show, we didn't do it every sketch and we didn't even do it every episode, but we got the audience to feel sorry for characters quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We got that Oh, react out loud reaction probably 3 or 4 times in 4 seasons. And that's a big deal. And you don't hear that on Saturday Night Live.
That's a real big deal.
And you don't even, probably Monty Python does that a few times.
Yeah.
Where you just feel bad for that person. you're genuinely sad for that, how dumb that character is and how much they're going to be abused by the world.
Well, I'll tell you what, the character you played on I Think You Should Leave achieved that.
Yes,
there's a real pathos, pathos to that guy.
Real pathos, yeah.
Which I loved. While we're talking about sketch comedy, my favorite Mr. Show sketch is the audition.
Sure.
Sketch.
Yeah, that's a very good one.
That's one of the all-timers as far as I'm concerned. It's clean and sharp.
Yeah.
Such a beautiful concept.
Yeah, thank you.
What are your memories of shooting that?
Dino Stamatopoulos wrote that sketch, one of the great sketch writers, and a joy to do. A hard thing to do because David had to do that sketch verbatim as written, no messing around. Because he does repeat himself exactly each time. A very high level of writing and performing on his part. Fun for me, just simply fun. And I love the sketch. For film buffs, we didn't riff on films as much as we did on the Ben Stiller show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because Ben is so film obsessed. And I worked on the Woody Allen Husbands and Wives, or Woody Allen's Frankenstein, which is Husbands and Wives.
I haven't seen that one. I've got to check it out.
Oh, it's good. Yeah. There's a lot of parody films on the Stiller show, but I think the best one is Woody Allen's Frankenstein.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Bob Odenkirk, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm glad you go, but thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Okay, that was Bob Odenkirk, and Normal is in cinemas right now, folks. It is a cracking time at the movies. Really, really good action movie, and we give it 4 stars. Go check it out. And you've probably already checked out The Devil Wears Prada 2, the long-awaited sequel to 2006's The Devil Wears Prada, which threw Anne Hathaway's idealistic young wannabe journalist into the world of high fashion magazine Runway and pitted her against terrifying editor Meryl Streep. Now the gang is back, including co-stars Emily Blunt and Stanley Tucci, director David Frankel, and writer Aline Brosh McKenna, and it has been lapped up by audiences worldwide. So it is a perfect time to bring you this chat with McKenna, who popped onto Zoom recently to talk about the movie just before its release with our Helen O'Hara. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast, Aline Brosh McKenna. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Congratulations on the film. Did you expect to be back here 20 years later?
You know, I didn't, but it's one of the things about being a writer, you don't have a regular workplace. You go where the tide takes you. And didn't expect that we'd be back here, but here we are.
I mean, it seems to be just, you know, people still completely love this story. And I think partly maybe that's because, let's be honest, stories about women at work are undercatered too. But I think also there is something about, there's something very satisfying about seeing people do things well. We talk a lot in the Empire Podcast about competence porn. Competence and Miranda porn. Priestley is
definitely that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, so Andy trying, you know, the book was a big hit. It took a while to figure out how to, you know, transpose the book to the screen initially. And what's interesting is the book was written by somebody who really did work in that workplace. And so it had a veracity that I think readers could feel that we wanted to capture in the movie. And same thing with this, we really are trying to capture with some authenticity what it's like to work within the media at this time and how challenging that is.
Really? I hadn't noticed.
Oh. I was going to say, I don't know if you know anything about that, but you know, the whole world has become, I've always had to be an entrepreneur. I've always had to find new jobs. And, you know, sort of now all the workplaces have become Uber and DoorDash and, you know, work piecework and work for hire. And the idea of having a cozy sinecure somewhere where you can lose money and nobody bothers you, it just doesn't happen anymore. And everyone has to pay their way. But it's so in a world where advertising doesn't mean it isn't the same there's, you know, eyeballs and clicks and likes and views and engagement and all these other metrics. Algo. People now say like, oh, what's on my algo? What's on your algo? It's just a fascinating, completely different way of looking at what it means to communicate in journalism. It's completely different.
Yeah. So was that the way back in? I mean, when did you guys start talking about this?
I mean, Dave and I have been friends since the first movie came out. And so we would talk frequently about, you know, how things were changing and how Hollywood was, you know, how our lives were changing. But then, you know, what would be happening to these characters? And, you know, I remember, I'm sure you remember getting on a plane with a stack of seven magazines, mm-hmm. you know, and now I get on a plane with a tiny metal device, you know, and I'm reading my book on there. I'm reading, well, quote unquote magazines. I'm reading quote unquote newspaper. I'm doing my crossword puzzle there. And so we live in a completely different environment of non-tangible things where a brand really matters, but what is it? What is it? What is, you know, and I grew up with, my parents would save the Time magazines, and there were like big stacks of Time magazines in our, den. And it's like, and now as she says in the movie, you know, entire publications get deleted, entire mm-hmm. cultural institutions get deleted. I also grew up with a giant World Book encyclopedia. And as a kid, you know, I would take down the World Book and read like G. and read the section on Gecko. I mean, that's ridiculous now, you know? And so just the idea of how information flows, power, fame, what's interesting, what a writer is, what a writer does, those were all such interesting things to engage with.
Yeah. And I guess it makes sense at this point that all that turbulence and all that change mm-hmm. might throw Andy and Miranda back together again, because I think David talked about this the other day, but like it wouldn't have made sense if they were back together a year later or 2 years later, you know, and you followed the usual sequel kind of rules.
No. And you know, we really weren't interested in it for a long time. And I think we felt like we had, as they say, dropped the mic on it. But once we started thinking about the world and then, you know, one of the things that's unusual was I started talking to David first, and then we talked to Meryl, and then we brought it to the studio. Mm. So it wasn't ordered by the studio. So, you know, in terms of sequels seeming like quote unquote cash grabs, if so, we gave them the, you know, we asked them, do you think there's cash to grab? We don't know. We just thought it was a good idea. The one of the differences is that the first movie was made by Fox 2000, which was a division of 20th Century Fox. And Fox 2000 was known for doing literary adaptations. Mm-hmm. They did Life of Pi and other sort of like highbrow movies, like they did Walk the Line. And so it was, we were made in sort of a female-based, somewhat literarily oriented subsidiary of 20th Century Fox. And then that got bought by Disney, and then 20th became part of Disney. So we're making it for 20th for Disney. So it's gone from being a Fox 2000 movie to a Disney movie, and that's a completely different entity. And it's also reflective and indicative of how the world has changed, but the people who made the movie are virtually identical. We're just working for a different corporate entity because of course, because everyone is, you know, because you sort of look up and say like, okay, wait, everybody works at companies where it's like, oh, who owns us now? Oh, okay. You know, so it's really been reflected in our experience because we made it at a place that was a little bit more like an artisanal cheese place. And then now we're making it the same way. It's really still artisanal cheese. It's still really virtually the same folks, but we're making it for an entity that can take that and transfer it into Diet Coke and hairspray and stuff
Walmart
like that
or something. Yeah.
Which I think Miranda herself would be very impressed with the marketing reach, because she's had to pivot from being solely someone who thinks mostly about, you know, beauty and design and high-end concerns, fashion, obviously, to someone who's had to stay alive, has had to figure out all this monetization and online presence and all those word without losing the sense of what she wants to do. And that's really what's in peril in this movie is, you know, Miranda has managed to find a little place where she can still do what she wants to do in this digital age, but it's getting pulled away from her.
Mm. And it feels like it's getting smaller. Even if the metrics online are still good, it's a very different world. Tell me then about Andy as well. Like, she's obviously made a name for herself. She's been working. She's been in journalism. Yeah. She's been doing what she went off to do.
Definitely.
But it, you know, that comes crashing down. No spoilers. Yes. In the first few scenes.
Yes. Well, as we were saying, you know, sometimes it's and not long. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I wrote that's in the movie was not happening when I wrote it, even though we made this very quickly. So, you know, the idea of like Washington Post firing so many people, that hadn't happened yet. A lot of the things that are in the movie that seem like they're pulled from the headlines, which you can't with the movie anyway, because the lead up time is so, they happened while we were making the movie. There were so many things that happened while we were making the movie that were in the script. That Meryl would like tease me about being a witch. But, you know, I think we can see the trends. I just think we don't know what to do. And there's a speech that that Benji, you know, the character Benji has sort of played by Justin Trudeau is such a, I think, brilliant performance that you have to kind of just let it come. You have to let it, you know, you have to figure out where this new world is taking you. And it's scary.
Mm. I really enjoyed that role. I was actually talking to someone who didn't realize it was Justin Theroux until after the movie. I think he was watching the credits and was like,
Yeah, people have said that. No, he did it. He disappeared. And one interesting thing about our cast is that a lot of the folks are also showrunners or writer directors, BJ, Patrick Bramall, Justin, Caleb Huron is a content creator. So there's a lot of folks who have multiple jobs and but are also sort of writer creators. And that's always really fun for me to work with people who do a similar job because they completely understand what I'm doing and the exigencies of what I do and how I do it. And that was really fun to have a lot of writer pals on set.
Mm. What about the sort of core four, if you like, you know, Nigel, Emily, Andy and Miranda, did they come in with requests for you or big, strong feelings about these characters?
Well, Emily had this is really embarrassing, but we didn't have a scene with all four of them.
Oh.
And she pointed that out when I first met with her, when we first met with her, and I felt very stupid. The scene that's in the conference room had three of them, but not four of them. And so we added, I think Nigel was not in that. And I mean, they're all filled with great ideas, you know, from tiny lines to big moments to, and because we have a shorthand now where they feel like, you know, I'm not one of those, please say everything exactly as scripted, or I'm going to cross my arms and stamp my feet and cry. I want it to be a live experience.
You're not Sorkining at them.
I did 62 episodes of a television show where, you know, my approach is shoot it once exactly as written if possible. And then, and pretty much we always did that. And then you can play around because you're also trying to convey information. If you throw out lines, without shooting them, you'll often go back and go, oh, wait, nobody said that that's that specific piece of information. And these actors are just very disciplined and very amazing at like getting what you need and then playing. And they're just all people I really enjoy playing with. Like even a little thing like Stanley had the line where he said he bought her a Monet. And then I just said to him, do you want to say and Clint? Just because Klimt is just a funny word and any word that starts with K is funny. And so, he just like doubles back and says, and Klimt. So just little things like that. I enjoy.
I mean, you compared, I think it was you that compared the first film to Wall Street, which is something I have repeated many times since, because I thought that was exactly right. Did you have a sort of like comparison or a model in mind for this? Because it is kind of almost like two gunslingers coming, teaming up to take down.
Broadcast News is one of my favorite movies.
Mm.
And I don't know that I don't know that I thought about it specifically, except insofar as Broadcast News, Tootsie, Jerry Maguire are sort of like the workplace comedies that I have come back to and watched multiple times. Broadcast news is also about an industry and an inflection point mm-hmm. where the visual is taking over from the informational, and where handsome people are becoming more important than, you know, and that's a movie that, you know, I can quote lots of that movie, but the contrast between the handsome guy and Albert Brooks, and that she is in the corner, she is in the crosshairs of this inflection point. I think that there's a connection there.
Mm, that makes sense. I feel like that's one of the most influential movies ever made. I feel like so many people I speak to cite that as an influence. It's an incredible movie.
Yeah, it really is. And Tootsie, for me, is my number one in terms of like how well I know it. And what I like about Tootsie is that he is wrong right from the beginning. When you see him in the beginning and he's talking to the students, he's being sort of a pompous ass. And I know that this is not primarily how people think about it, but in the first Prada movie, she's wrong. She thinks she's better than it and everyone. And there's a little smugness to her. And that's to me, there's the DNA of Tootsie, where he thinks he's above something. And then he realizes there are humans there.
Very much so. So do you think you'll be back in another 20 years to explore the state of journalism further?
I mean, I don't know about 20 years. I don't know. it's funny because I was the youngest on the creative team, not on screen. The gals were young, but younger. But I was sort of one of the younger people on the creative team the first time. And I still get to be the young person now, which is great. I never feel younger.
Yeah, it was only your third film or something at that point?
It was my third film, yes. And I can't say that the first two were international blockbusters, but I had gotten a good amount of experience. But I, you know, the magic for me was that David and I just have a shared vision. You know, we have some surface things not in common, but otherwise a lot in common. And both movies were built in conversation with each other, and we have different points of view, different temperaments. But that's sort of one of the luckiest work blind dates I've ever been on.
Long may it continue to be. So I wanted to just finish up this part of the interview, at least, asking you just about, you know, people's reaction to maybe people who've seen it to this movie, mm-hmm. but also just the long tail of the last one. You know, what's been surprising about the way that people have talked to you about it over the years? What theories or anything have people come up with, or reactions that you didn't expect?
Well, it's so rewatchable for people, and I don't know what that is because I have those movies for myself. But that's something that you can't quite, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure why that's a movie that people will watch all the way through if it pops back up, but I know I have mine that are like that. And, you know, sometimes they're the most unexpected things, but there's something familiar but surprising. I think it's a combination of familiar and surprising. But I get, you know, I'm happy about how many young women respond to this movie. Obviously, we have a lot of support from the gay community, and I trust their taste so much in so many areas. And and then, you know, it's funny how many men want to come up to me and say, well, they'll sometimes tell me they like the movie, but boy, people really like to say, oh, my wife, my sister, my daughter, blah blah blah, and love that movie. And I always take it as them telling me they liked it too.
I think that's right. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with the movie.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Aline Brosh McKenna talking about The Devil Wears Prada 2 with Helen O'Hara. And if you haven't seen that film, it's in cinemas everywhere at the moment. And if you want more from Aline, then the pair of them went on to talk spoilers for the film. And you can hear that chat in our The Devil Wears Prada 2 spoiler special, which will be up on Monday, May 18th, featuring me, Helen, and Clarice Lockery as well, making her Empire podcast debut. And if you don't already subscribe to our spoiler specials, I can thoroughly recommend them. Check out empiresportespecials.com for details on how to sign up. It'll be well worth your while. And on that note, that is it for this week's episode of The Interviews. The main Empire podcast is up, featuring a lovely chat between John Nugent and Ian McKellen, and plenty of film-related fun featuring me, Helen, James Dyer, and Harry Stainer. So check that out wherever you cast your pods. Thank you for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.